tonight's lecture actually starts the next section. So we have finished with state-based searching as a reasoning technique. And as I mentioned earlier, probably at the start of the previous section, it's important for two reasons. First of all, it's a reasoning technique on its own. You're using it to solve, for example, your homework assignment. But it also is the basis for other reasoning techniques. So other reasoning techniques will build upon the idea of searching. Okay, and we're going to see that in this lecture because this section is essentially going to take up the reasoning technique known as constraint-based reasoning. So that's going to be the topic of the next four lectures and is also the topic of the next set of readings in Chapter 4 in Mackworth and Poole. And today's lecture, in keeping with the general theme of the course, is going to be an examination of the data structures that are used in constraint-based reasoning, which, not surprisingly, are called constraints. And then starting next week, we will look at the algorithms that you use, which are known as constraint satisfaction algorithms, which are in various ways based on the notion of search. We'll be looking at constraint-based reasoning, and this is actually a particularly nice way to not only specify problems, but also solve them. It's a little tricky in the solving part, but it's a really nice way to specify them. There have been, at various times, fairly important systems that are organized around the notion of constraint-based reasoning, and those turn out to be actually kind of fun to play with. But to start, we have to figure out what the problem representation is when you talk about representing a problem in terms of constraints. So let's do that. And we're going to start, essentially, constraint-based reasoning, in addition to using state search as a basic technique, is also derived from the notion of state-based search. So let's start by reviewing what we know about state-based search. So let's think about what we know about state-based search. And since this is a sort of data structure-based lecture, what is the data structure involved in state-based search? What's the principal data structure in state-based search?
Structures.
What kind of structures? Yes. What kind of structures? Can you be a little more specific? Or anyone can jump in and answer that question. What is the data structure, the principal data structure, in state-based search as a reasoning technique? Not surprisingly, it is the state-space graph. You can use arrays to implement this data structure, but that's not the actual data structure. It's the state-space graph. And again, from your experience with the first programming assignment, what are some of the problems associated with state-space graphs? In fact, what is probably the principal problem there? There's a number of problems, but the principal one is, yes, searching, but why is, I mean, we've just gone through a bunch of algorithms, right? Depth-first search, breadth-first search, A-star search, iterative deepening, heuristic-based search, extreme cost search, right? So we've gone through a bunch of those, and they're not that complicated, really. I mean, they're all essentially variations on the generic search algorithm. You just plug in queues or stacks or priority queues. Not a big deal. I mean, it's not completely trivial, but it's also not brain-busting. What is the big deal? What is the problem? It's the size of the state space graph, right? These things can become enormous. Right? Some of the examples that your program, your solver has to solve have like 100 holes on a side. That's an enormous state space. So the principal difficulty here, and in fact the growth, as we'll demonstrate here, the growth of the state space is generally speaking exponential. So there's exponential growth in the state space graph. And where does that growth come from? Why is it exponential? Well, that's true. It's not infinite, but that doesn't really help you much if you have exponential growth. It can get pretty big pretty quickly. So even though it's finite, that's not a very ameliorating effect. What makes graphs big? The number of states, right? The problem here is that you have exponential growth in the state space graph, and that translates into exponential growth in states. You have exponentially many states. So it appears that states are the problem. They're growing very quickly. And there are some other problems with states. What are they? What were some of the other problems we had with states? And this you should know from your experience working on the simple examples that we had talked about 2 weeks ago when we talked about states. Right, the robot example. So one state problem is exponential growth. What was another problem? You actually had to define the state. So you had to figure out how to actually represent the problem in terms of a reasonable state definition. And then you had the problem of state enumeration, right, which is sort of related to exponential growth. Right, that was essentially the state set, the set of states. So states have a lot of problems associated with them, but the principal one is this idea of exponential growth. Right? This thing, the fact that you have exponential growth, means that you are not going to be able to solve relatively big problems. And that's going to be a fundamental limit. So if we're going to improve on this idea of state-space graph, we're going to have to somehow deal with these issues with respect to state. And that's what we're going to be talking about here. That's going to be our new data structure. It is a data structure that allows us to deal with the state problems in a way that somehow makes it easier to deal with exponential growth. Now, it's important to understand exponential growth is a characteristic of the problem. All right? If you're dealing with a complex problem, then there are going to be many possible solutions. In other words, the state space associated with that is going to be naturally exponential. So there's not going to be any particular way that you're going to be able to deal with that. But what you do want is you want a more convenient representation of that large state space so that it's easier to manipulate. Right? If your initial representation is, well, enumerate every state and put them in a graph, then yes, you're going to end up with an exponentially large data representation for that problem. On the other hand, if you can come up with a more compact representation, you still are dealing with essentially an exponentially many state space, but you have a much more compact representation, so it becomes easier to, in a sense, manipulate. That's going to be the key. So we can't avoid exponential numbers of states, but we can have a more compact representation than just enumerating them. So we want to get around this enumeration problem. We need to solve the enumeration problem. We can't get around exponential growth unless you change the problem, which may be a valid thing to do, and if not, then you're stuck with it. But we want to do something a little bit more intelligent than enumerate. So we need a data structure that allows us to come up with something that will represent the same state space but not rely on enumerating each state in the space. That's the question we want to answer. And what we want is a data structure that will support that. So let's think. And to do that, let's look at an example to motivate ourselves. Let's go back to the robot problem. All right, so here's our robot problem. What was the state we developed for this robot problem? Yes, we talked about the state space, but what I'm interested in now is what is the state associated with any particular... So what are the vertices in that state space? So we had the robot coordinates, and then we had possible moves. All right, so each state space member had some coordinates that represented the robot's position in this grid, and then the possible moves that robot could engage in. And so now what we're going to do is, and this was the state. Now what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at that. We're going to abstract information.
Obstructions?
Right. What about it? Correct. But that's taken care of by the number of possible moves. So if the robot is here, there are some moves that it cannot make, and that's taken care of by enumerating the possible moves it can make. If a move's not in that list, then that's a move that it can't take. So this is one way to take into account obstructions. And you can imagine that as the as the grid gets bigger, and in fact, as the grid gets infinite, the state will grow because you're essentially going to be adding more and more robot positions, and that essentially will grow. In this case, it'll grow as the square, not exponentially, but still, that's a large number. So the way in which we're going to do this is we are essentially going to move from states to a more abstract representation, which is based on features. And features are essentially going to be equivalent to the individual values in a state. So you can think of a state as a tuple of values. And the features would then represent the individual values in a state. And essentially what we are doing here is we are abstracting the individual values and replacing them by a representation for those values. Okay, now this is an abstraction that's pretty obvious to most people because it corresponds to the idea of a variable in a programming language. Right, when you write a variable in your programming languages, what are you doing? Or, for that matter, in mathematics, what are you doing? Yes, you're doing that, but in addition to that, you're doing something else, and what is that? Yes, that's right. They have names, but, I mean, why do you introduce a variable? What's the point? Why are you doing that? Right, and what does that represent? So what are you doing when you do that? Well, no, don't think about memory. We're going in the opposite direction. We're going higher, not lower. A variable in a programming language is a representation for all the possible values that variable could hold, right? It's a declaration of it holds a value, but I don't really care what that value is. Okay, so a variable represents all the individual possible values that could be obtained at that point. Right, because if I asked you to compute the area of a circle, how could you do that? Well, you could say that if I have a circle of radius 1, then the area of the circle is equal to 2 pi times 1. Okay, but if you want a area, so this is area of a circle of radius 1, and then if I wanted to compute the area of a circle of radius 2, well, that's easy too. I would just go AC2 is equal to 2 pi times 2. Actually, that's wrong because that is the area is, this is the circumference, this is pi r squared. Well, circumference, all right, that's fine too. It's pi r squared, pi times 1 squared, and this is pi times 2 squared, and then the area of the circle of radius 3 is pi times 3 squared. Right, now that's a pretty tedious way to write a program. What's a better way to write this program? Exactly, you say that rather than compute these individually, I will say that the area of a circle of radius r is equal to pi times r squared. So I have replaced all the individual radiuses with an abstraction of the radius. So you can think of each one of these as a state. In the solution space, what's the area of a circle? Okay, and that's an infinitely big state space. But if I stay and said, well, the area of the circle is pi r squared, then I have essentially represented that infinite state space in this one representation. And that's exactly the transformation we're making up here. Okay? The state space has as a feature the radius. Okay? Which essentially means that for each possible value of the radius, we can compute the area. So we will take that, rather than have a bunch of these things down here, we'll just say, all right, the important feature here is the radius, and we will represent that as a variable. Okay, now I have collapsed the infinite state space down into one representation, which is pi r squared. So how can we apply this technique to this problem? How can we get a finite well, this is always going to be finite, unless you have an infinite grid. But even if you do have an infinite grid, we can still get a finite representation. And what would that representation look like? In other words, what are the set of features that you can use to represent this particular state in this problem? Yes, and that's done as a consequence of the problem, right? You have to have some indication of what the start state is, and then you have to either have an indication or a predicate that tells you what the goal state is. But that still doesn't absolve you of the responsibility to create the state space or use this representation. We could list down a bunch of states. So give me some states in this representation. No. This is the state we use to describe instances of this problem. Give me some examples of it. Well, I mean, just what are the states? States are robot coordinates and moves, right? So here's an example of a state. Here's a coordinate, 0, 0, and here's a set of moves, left, right, up, down. That's one state in this problem. And here's another one, 0, 1, and left, right. Okay, and so on and so forth. There's a large number of these things. But what I would like to do is apply this transformation where I take this long list of pi times 3 squared, pi times 4 squared, and transform it into this nice compact representation. So what would this long list of states look like transformed into an equivalent compact representation? We want to apply the same transformation. I don't want to list each individual move because there could be infinitely many of them. So I don't want to do that. This is what I'm doing here. This is what I'm doing here. There are infinitely many of these things. If we assume that this is an infinite grid, okay, I don't want to do that. I want to have some kind of representation that looks like this. And it turns out that's slightly a trick question because the answer is right here. I have two features, and the way to think about this is, how would you describe this state? You would describe it exactly like this. There are two features in this state. There are robot coordinates, and there are possible next moves. Okay, those are the two features of this state. Therefore, I will take these two features and turn them into variables. So my representation now for the state is just robot coordinates and possible moves. That is a transformation that is similar to going from here to here, because the features of this particular formula are the radius, right? Pi is a constant, so that doesn't change. It's like the obstacles here are constants. They don't change, so I don't need to include them in each one of my state representations. I'm only interested in the things that change in my state representations. So this becomes the compact representation of all these possible states. These are the variables. So again, the robot coordinates and the possible moves are the variables. And taken together, they represent a particular instance of the problem. Does everyone understand that transformation? I mean, it's a pretty straightforward and simple transformation. But it's essentially the key here. And again, you can think of this example or this example, and we'll go over some other examples later on once we're done with the main part of the lecture. So we've introduced this notion of a feature, which is essentially, you can think of it as a component of a state representation. And then once you know what the features are, you can represent them by variables to indicate particular aspects of the problem, particular states of the problem. There are a few other terms that we have to become familiar with. And this goes back to the idea of types that you sort of introduced. An important concept, once we introduce the idea of variables, is the notion of a domain, which is essentially the legal set of values that you can assign to a variable. And what is this similar to? What is the notion of a domain similar to? It's not exactly the same, but it's similar to. It is, right, it's related to the features, but with respect to, just in general, with respect to programming, this is similar to the idea of a type. The reason they're not exactly the same is that types are a more restrictive form of determining legality than just relying on a domain. In addition, the set of features associated with a state, and in particular the variables and their assignment of values, is known as a possible world. And this is essentially equivalent to the idea of a state. So these are the variables, where each variable has an appropriate value from its domain. And then that represents a state. So what we're interested in then is the possible world. So this, in fact, represents a possible world for the area calculation. And that kind of makes sense, right? Because this essentially represents all possible areas of circles, right? Because you just plug in a radius and you can compute the area. So when you do that, when you actually put a value to the variable r, then you have an actual radius, so you have a possible world here. You have the actual radius of a, sorry, not radius, area of a particular circle. And I believe that's all we need. This essentially is our representation. We're actually going to put a few more fill-ups on here. Yes, so each variable is a feature from the state that you're modeling, and the set of all variables from a particular from a particular state is known as a possible world. And that's it. Are there any questions about that? I mean, it's a relatively simple concept, but it's the key. It's the important point. So let's go back here and take a look and see whether we've actually solved problems. Have we solved the problem of exponential growth? You can see that, again, not so much with the robot problem because that's so small, but if we think about this problem where we have an infinite number of area calculations, then we've represented that by a single formula or a single set of features, which essentially just means the radius. So, yeah, we've handled that. Notice that we still have an infinite number of possible worlds here, right? Possible areas of circles. But we only need to look at one at a time. As opposed to, for example, if we tried to draw the state space graph of the areas of circles, we'd have an infinite number of states. So we have taken care of that. We haven't taken care of the state definition problem because essentially we extracted the features from our definition of the state. So we still have the problem of either coming up with the state and turning those into features or coming up with the features directly. And to a certain extent, you're not going to get rid of that, because that's the nature of solving the problem. You're given a problem, and you have to transform that into a data structure. And then finally, we've gotten rid of the state enumeration problem because we have a finite representation of a potentially infinite number of states in terms of the possible world. So this looks like a reasonable approach to dealing with the problems we identified with respect to state and state space. So it seems as if we're on the right track. Now, this is part of our data structure, but we actually need to augment more of it. And why is that? What is missing from the notion of features and possible worlds that was more or less present in the state? Oh, actually, before we do that, let's go back here. So domains. We've defined two features, robot coordinates and possible moves. We have variables associated with those, which are also called robot coordinates and possible moves. What are the domains? So here's a problem we have. Let's just think of this. What is the domain? And the usual term here is DOM. What is the domain of robot positions? Your claim is the only two positions the robot can be in is the start state and the goal state. Well, again, what is the domain? Exactly.
Positions
of the robot. So that's what? That's essentially a coordinate in a two-dimensional plane. So it's a 2D coordinate. And we can make it be 2D integral coordinate. All right, so this is a two-dimensional coordinate. And what's the domain of the possible moves? Okay, but what's the representation? Yeah, I mean, I guess one answer to the question is, well, it's whatever you want it to be, right? But assuming that we're going to stick close to the state representation, what would be the domain of the possible moves? So it's a set of directions, and now, of course, it can be whatever you want. you have the ability to define whatever the domain of these variables are. But if we're going to stick reasonably close to our representation in the robot problem, then it's going to be two-dimensional coordinates and a set of directions. Now the question is that adequate? Is that a good representation, or is there some problem here? In fact, it makes the program more compact, right? Because you don't need the state-space graph anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, just think of how compact your first programming assignment would be if you didn't need to have the entire state-space graph to search through. From that point, and that's in fact the problem we're trying to solve, right? But there's actually another problem here, and that problem is, it's true that the domain of the 2D coordinate, sorry, the domain of the robot position is a 2D coordinate. But are all 2D coordinates in the domain of, are all 2D coordinates valid robot positions? For example, this is 0, 0. So is this a valid robot position? It is. Where is it on this particular little grid? It's not valid because there's an obstruction there. There's an obstruction there. Is this a valid 2D coordinate? Yes, minus 1 and minus 1. Is that a valid 2D coordinate? It isn't. Why not? Notice I said 2D coordinate. It is valid. It's a valid 2D coordinate. Now, this is the question you answered. Is it a valid robot position? It is a valid robot position. Where is it? Right, it's not a valid robot position. So the problem here is we have more values that we can assign to the robot position that are than are legal. All right, so we have too many possible values to assign to this particular feature. All right, there's another problem here too. Let us consider a possibility where we have robot position being 1, 1. And possible moves being, this is a 2D coordinate, right? Everyone will agree with me. This is a set of moves. Okay, everyone agree with me? Okay, so I can assign both of these values to their respective variables. That gives me a possible world, right? A state, in other words. Everyone agree? Now the question is, does this possible world represent anything over in this problem? It should? Okay, does it though? That's the question. That's my question to you. Does it represent a state in this possible world? This is the abstraction. This is a possible world, right? Does it represent a possible world in this problem? Why not? Exactly. The move that I show here is not possible, right? Because the robot at 1, 1 is here. Right, and so the robot cannot move right. It can move left, and it could also move up. No, that says R. Right, this is a possible move. That's an R. That's it. Okay, so while both of these are valid assignments of values to variables, right, this is in the appropriate domain, and so is that, this possible world does not represent something that can exist here. So what's missing is some way to prevent these kinds of assignments, right? Not all assignments are valid. And if we're going to have a useful representation of our problem, we need some way to prevent these kinds of invalid assignments. In other words, we need to have some way to prevent these ridiculous or impossible or useless possible worlds. Well, let me not say impossible, but, well, I guess in one sense, it is impossible, but let me just say invalid. All right, everyone understand what the problem is. The problem is, just by specifying a domain, we haven't done enough. We have to somehow further limit the values that you can assign to a particular variable, robot position, for example, in ways that produce valid possible worlds. All right? And this is where constraints come in. Because if you'll notice, the title of this section is constraint-based reasoning. So a constraint is a way to restrict the values that can be assigned to a possible the variables in a possible world, or the features in a possible world, in such a way that the resulting possible world is valid. And in particular, what we are going to be looking at are what is known as hard constraints. They're also known as simple constraints. Okay, there's other kinds of constraints that we're not going to spend too much time on. In fact, there's a huge number of constraint types. So what we need is some technique for limiting the way in which we can assign values to variables. Now, what's the most obvious way to do that? The most obvious way is essentially to list them. List all the valid values, or alternatively, equivalently, list all the invalid values. That's what's known as an explicit constraint. Is that the right word? It doesn't sound right to me. No, it's called an extensional constraint. Sorry. So you just list them. Which sounds kind of troublesome, but it's a technique to use it. And if I've defined extensional constraints, what's the intentional constraint? Oh, I just told you the answer. The other constraint is known as intentional. And in this case, you characterize the legal values. Rather than explicitly listing them, you characterize them. And we will take a look at these two techniques when we come back on next Tuesday, when we actually look at the ways in which you can start to specify problems using this. For now, and I guess to finish up, since we're running out of time, let's get some examples. So what would be the extensional constraints on the robot position? Could you give me the extensional constraints on the robot position? I'll just call that EC on the robot position. It could either be the obstruction coordinates, or it could be the coordinates that are not obstructed. In this case, the obstructed coordinates are easier to do. So in this case, we would have something like it's not in the set, whatever it is there. What is it? That's 0, 0 or 2, 1. Is that good enough? Does this serve as a constraint? See, and this is the tricky thing about constraints, is getting this right. Is this strong enough to constrain the values that we store in robot position to be only legal values? Right, what's missing? Exactly. -1, -1 satisfies this constraint, and that's not valid. So if we're going to use explicit coordinates, then listing the values that are not valid is essentially an infinite set because it includes negative coordinates. All right, so in this case, we want to flip this around and list the values that are possible. So in that case, it would be whatever it is. I guess it would be 1, 0, and 2, 0, and 3, 0. And what is it, 3 or 4? 1, 2, 3. Well, no, we're starting from 0. So, no, I guess we're starting. No, I didn't do this right. Yeah, 1, 0. Right, that's it. So, in the first row, it's these three coordinates, and on the second row, it is 0, 1, and 1, 1, and 4, 1. Now, every value in here are legal values. And you might say, well, that's great, but what would your objection be? Suppose that this is infinite. So that takes us to intentional constraints for robot position. And how would you characterize the legal states in a way that doesn't involve listing them, but characterizing them? Yes, but what are they? That's what we need to do. Well, what about X? What are legal values for X? It has to be between 0 and 3. What about 1? It has to be between 0 and 1. Now, does this represent all possible legal moves? Not really, because we still have those two obstructions. So that's and x is not equal to 0. And y is not equal to 0. And x is not equal to 2, and y is not equal to 1. Notice that this works for an infinite grid. So here, and of course you could do a similar thing for the domain of possible moves. You can constrain those. That's a little bit more complicated because you have to take in the account of the obstacles. You might do an explicit listing, or you might do in an intentional constraint. So this is essentially going to be the data structure that we're going to manipulate, and this is the data structure that you'll be using in your second programming assignment. And then when we come back on Tuesday, we will now start to look at algorithms for manipulating this particular data structure to produce intelligent-like behavior. Are there any questions?